linoleum knife. I just knocked everything everywhere.
This is a test of the funky broadcast system.
Did I miss? Did I screw everything up?
No, it's fine.
I just knocked stuff. I didn't hurt anything. Oh, yeah, it stopped.
You missed my killer robot.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is not a video podcast.
If this were a video podcast, you would have just been watching Alonzo chair dancing.
Mm, getting down.
Attitude dancing.
Thank you, Carly Simon.
You would have been.
Do the mashed potato with a new attitude.
You would have. He was roboting.
Yes.
There was no reason I played that song. Great. Other than that, I just liked that song.
No, you know what? We didn't even talk about it. You didn't feel like bringing it up. But my music choice week had no connection either.
To anything.
It was just awesome.
5 minutes ago, he said it's your turn to pick the music, so I just dug through the cassettes until I found that the name of that song is Test 4, the number 4.
Mm.
And the name of the, it's not even a band.
Uh-huh.
It's some dude.
With a keyboard.
Yeah, who called himself Sweet Exorcist. This is like 1991, I think, or 90 something. It's, you know.
I was playing the Percy Faith Orchestra last week, but I don't remember the name of the song.
Of that time, that late 80s, early 90s, you know.
Sound.
Let's go to a field out in the open somewhere and dance. And then when the sun comes up, everyone, hold your arms in the air.
tell them the...
You've been on E all night long.
Tell them that Douglas Copeland line.
I'm going to forget what it is.
I want to hear love songs written by robots and performed on cash registers.
Yeah, yeah. That's a song written by a robot and performed on a cash register.
Truly.
It's Coco Day. It's not tea day. It's Coco Day. It's super pouring rain outside.
Which is a great rarity here in the City of the Angels. Mm-hmm. And so we're enjoying it and having Coco
Day. Don't call it that. I don't like it. I don't like it when people say City of the Angels or the worst, the City of Lost Angels.
Who says that?
People in movies.
Besides that people movie, Lost Angels.
People in terrible movies, and not just in that movie, Lost Angels.
Okay.
People in terrible movies and people who write terrible things about Los Angeles and about how dark and
I would like to say that I'm going
to
say put money on the fact that James Ellroy probably never called L.A.
Well, good for
the
him.
The City of Lost Angels.
But people do that. I mean, dummies is what I'm trying to say. Dummies do that.
Fine. I'll just refer to it as this town for now on.
That's actually better.
Ew.
No, that's actually better.
This town is to Los Angeles what South By is to South By Southwest. I
don't even like, here's what a purist I've become in 12 years of living here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even like it when people just call it L.A.
Oh.
Because you know what people in New York...
It's like Frisco.
Dude, people in... Frisco's funny. I think Frisco should
be
used.
Yeah, but if you live there, they hate it.
I know, but people who live in San Francisco should totally call it Frisco.
Well, yeah, like our friend Matt who had it tattooed on his arm.
Our friend Matt has the word Frisco tattooed on his neck.
Neck, that's
on his
right.
Neck. And he lives there.
He's a pot stirrer, forever. That Matt.
Yeah. But people in New York City don't say, I live in NYC, baby. They don't.
They might.
They don't.
If they're singing that song from Annie, they are.
They don't. I don't even know what you're talking about.
NYC.
Oh, I do remember that song.
Just got here this morning.
All right, stop. Yeah. Quit it. Did you know I own... Let's get back to that in just a second.
Okay.
I'll get back to that Annie song in a second.
Put a pin in that.
Yeah. In the movie, Los Angeles plays itself. And I don't remember if it's actually in the movie or if it's or if it was in an interview I read with the director.
This
is a documentary called Los Angeles Plays Itself.
Not to be confused with the porn movie Plays Itself.
Yeah, there's a documentary that
came out. In case people are Googling it, I want to make sure.
A few years ago, a documentary came out called Los Angeles Plays Itself about...
how Los Angeles is used as a set, basically.
Or even a character.
A character in movies.
In movies. And It's 3 hours, and every minute of it is fascinating,
super compelling,
and fun, and cool to watch. Makes you want to go look at every movie that he shows you. You can't get it on. What's that noise?
That's Gary Cotti.
Oh, go answer the door.
Okay.
Anyway, so he answers the he said that he doesn't like it when people call it L.A. either. Hang on just a minute, podcast listeners. Gary Cotti, our neighbor, has made an entrance into our apartment. He's borrowing Downton Abbey Season 2. Now he's leaving. Was that him doing the Dowager Countess on his way down the steps? No, but he doesn't like it when people say L.A. He likes to say Los Angeles. And I agree with him about that, because I think it cheapens the experience of living here. And I think that this city is, in 12 years...
This is the time that I'm going to say, if you've never read Dave White's memoir, Exile in Guyville, about his initial reluctance to become an Angeleno, you really should ought to read it, because it's hilarious. And it's doubly hilarious that you are now being Mr. Chamber of Commerce and don't say L.A.
I have been the Chamber of Commerce for years now, even before my book came out. That memoir that you should read, called Exile in Guyville, has the painful, heart-stirring chronicle of a young man.
Of how I fixed your life.
Of a very young man who moved to Los Angeles. Who moved to Los Angeles.
Kicking and screaming.
And did not enjoy himself much at first. And so, but now I'm full of enjoyment. All the time. You're not going to hear a negative word out of me about Los Angeles. Ever. I love living here.
Nor will we ever hear you call it L.A., apparently.
No, you're not going to hear me call it L.A. Although, on my Facebook page the other day, I did so with an intention of being jokey.
Ah.
Yeah.
What about Randy Newman's I Love L.A.?
He's fine. He can do whatever he wants. He writes songs I don't care about. So.
I like his pre-Pixar work.
Yeah. But so, what were we
and
about?
I bet you like his like late 60s, you know, when Nilsson was covering him era. Well,
yeah.
Yeah, because you're a music snob.
Where were we going?
Tom Anderson, Los Angeles, no, cheapens it by calling it L.A.
What was the point of the whole, where do we go off on this table?
It's raining.
Oh, it's raining in this city of angels.
In the city of angels.
In the city of angels.
Now, what about the song from Annie?
Excuse me. I owned the original Broadway cast album of Annie when I was a kid.
Of course you did.
Here's why.
Because you were a gay wad.
No, it has nothing to do with that, actually.
I owned it as well, don't get me wrong. But my sister Jolie owned it, but
it didn't have anything to do with gayness.
Oh, yes, it did.
No, we just shut up and let me finish telling my thing here. When I was a little kid, I would come home, and I think I may have actually touched on this once before. When I was a little kid, I would come home from school and watch all the... I'd have a bowl of cereal when I came home from school, and I would watch all the talk shows that were on while I did, like, my homework or whatever.
Mike, Merv, Dinah.
Yeah. That's what was on TV. There were only three channels.
Right.
And other than that, it was, you know, the UHF stations that...
We're showing old Woody Woodpecker cartoons?
Yeah, and I'd already seen those.
And McHale's Navy?
Like, if they were showing The Three Stooges or The Little Rascals or Ultraman or Simba the White... Or Kimba the White Lion?
Kimba the White Lion.
Kimba the White Lion. I would change for those because I liked all four of those a lot. I liked The Three Stooges. I liked The Little Rascals. I liked Ultraman.
Tom and Jerry, Woody Woodpecker, Heckle and Jekyll.
No.
But then I hated it when they would show those sort of artsy 50s Tom and Jerry cartoons where there was no dialogue but a lot of bad jazz.
Yeah.
Ugh, those are the worst.
I would watch those four shows, but otherwise I would watch the talk shows.
Okay.
And back in the 70s on the talk shows, there was still that weird last stab at trying to pretend like Broadway was popular music. And occasionally it would be, but not very often.
It's what Rosie O'Donnell revived when she did her daytime show, because she too grew up watching Mike and
Merv. It was on the wane,
right?
As mass popular music, like Broadway used to be the mass popular.
Yeah, that's where the hits came from.
Yeah, but I would see these grown-ups mm-hmm. on these shows all talking about, you know, Broadway music,
Broadway,
the theater. You know, it was very important.
Right.
And I knew in my head that the music I liked was The Partridge Family, which was apparently for children.
Right.
No one ever told me that, but, you know, the adults around me all sort of poo-pooed The Partridge Family, including my older brothers, who thought, you know, that it was exactly what it was, a made-up band for TV for children to enjoy. Anyway.
Yes.
It seemed to me like grown-ups, they listened to theater music. And there was nothing I wanted more as a child than to be a grown-up.
Yes.
Right away.
Sophisticated. Mature.
Sophisticated and mature immediately, if possible, because I couldn't deal with the other kids in my neighborhood.
No, please. I used to carry a copy of I'm OK, You're OK around when I was in the sixth grade.
I did not.
I never opened it, but I just knew that it was a book that all the adults were reading. So I totally get where you're coming from on this one.
You made that up.
I'm serious.
You did not.
I did. My older sister had bought a copy.
You're okay. Did you bring it to school?
Yes.
What did people say?
My teacher was like, are you reading that? And I was like, yeah.
Lying.
Never did.
I don't know what that book is about.
It's one of those stupid self-help books.
I remember it being a book that was popular in the 70s. Yeah. Anyway. I had this idea that I was going to be an adult, and right. that adults listened to theater music.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Goulet.
So I, as a kid, I'm like middle school, junior high school, seventh grade maybe, I joined the Columbia House.
To get Broadway scores?
Yeah.
Dave White, how do you never told me this story?
I did this.
Here you are sneering through Smash, and I didn't know you had this whole shameful show tune past.
No, it lasted for three albums.
Which were?
Okay, I got Annie.
Right.
And then I got a chorus line.
Sure.
And then I got They're Playing Our Song.
Ooh, Lucy Arnaz and Lawrence Luckinbill, right?
I saw them do like a disco song.
On a talk show. I saw that too. And I remember that.
And I was like,
it's probably on YouTube.
That's disco music. Adults like disco music.
Book by?
I don't know.
Neil Simon.
Really? Okay, so anyway.
Loosely based on?
I don't know.
The lives of Burt Bacharach and Carol Bayer-Sager.
See, this is all new information to me. All I knew and cared about was grown-ups were doing
right,
this.
Right, right, right.
And then, like...
I
listened to the records, and I actually listened to all three of them quite a bit, and kept trying to figure out what it was that people liked about any of it.
Why is this remotely appealing?
Because especially a chorus line.
Really?
It just seemed like everyone was yelling.
Well, yeah, if you haven't seen the show, I could see where that would be.
Didn't seem like anyone was singing in a chorus line. They were all just like, meh. And I mean, obviously, it's funny hearing, coming from me, to hear, I don't like it when people yell.
Yeah, right.
Because, I mean...
But they were going... Rah, rah, rah,
rah, rah. My future musical taste evolved into something where I only like it when people are yelling, but...
They were saying, locked in the bathroom with Peyton plays.
Right.
Yes.
So, it was not a... We weren't a good match.
You and Show Tunes.
And Show Tunes. Although, because I was a child... Annie appealed to me the most.
Well, of course.
Because she was an orphan. And she wanted nice people to come make her life different. And so eventually they did.
In a big city.
And that was great. And so, but I remember that song, NYC.
Yeah. You never got to see any of these shows at the time.
No.
Because see,
to this day, I've still never seen any of those three shows.
Really? Okay. Because
on a stage, I saw the movie Annie, and I saw the movie. Oh,
the movie Chorus Line is an abomination.
Which is like one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life.
No, well, here's I got taken to see the tour of Annie when it came to through Atlanta.
Right.
I also got taken to the tour of the Magic Show with Doug Henning.
I don't know what that was.
That was a musical. Doug Henning wasn't originally a magician, but he got cast in the lead of this thing called The Magic Show, and sort of that's how he became a magician.
Are you kidding me?
Seriously. I know. That's anyway, so weird. But I didn't own that album. And then A Chorus Line was actually the first Broadway show I saw on Broadway because I was 15 and I was visiting my brother in New York and when he was doing his, he was in medical school. And he was, and I remember wanting to see Sweeney Todd because it was about, you know, like murder.
Murders.
And he was like, you know what? I want to see A Chorus Line. And everybody I know has already seen A Chorus Line, so I'm taking you to see A Chorus Line. And so now, of course, I always tell him, I'm gay because you took me to see A Chorus Line when I was 15 years old. Hope you're happy. No, I was already plenty gay by that point. But anyway, so I had a lot of these records too, but I at least had the album that we had of the show that I have still never seen. I think we even did it at my high school when I didn't see it. It was Pippin.
Yeah.
My sisters had bought that.
All I know about Pippin is...
Corner of the Sky.
All I know about Pippin is the song they sing on Gilmore Girls.
Yes. Oh, magic to do.
It drives everyone to try to kill themselves.
That is one of my favorite Gilmore Girls moments ever, where the kids are coming through and they're throwing glitter and they're trying to get the audience to participate, and Lorelai's just like, oh, no, 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 no. Because, yeah, that's one of those songs that, like, you know, it's great when Ben Vereen does it or whatever, but, man, you know, you don't want to hear anybody else do it. And Corner of the Sky quickly became quickly became a staple of, like, 70s high school talent shows. Greg sings it on the Brady Variety Hour.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. Gotta find my corner of the sky.
It's like never super, heard that song.
It's like the most 70s me decade song.
What year was Pippin?
Pippin was... Oh, the gays listening are going to know. I'm going to say 74, but I'm not going to hold it that right one. By.
I don't know that song at all.
William Catt actually starred in the original production. Yeah.
He was in Carrie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And he was the greatest American hero.
Right. That too. I don't know. I don't know anything about Pippin. All I know is that I own those three albums.
You have never told me this story before.
I listened to them like studiously. Like I was like
trying to crack the code of adulthood.
Like, I will learn to enjoy. Like each record had like a song that I thought I like this song.
You liked one, right?
Yeah.
From A Chorus Line?
No, no. I don't. What song did I like from A Chorus Line?
Nothing?
I like Nothing. Mm. Yeah, because that was funny.
Yeah.
And my friend Ann performed it at the high school talent show.
Oh, funny.
With all the swears taken out.
Of course.
And when she performed it, I was like, I know that song.
Did she do it all Puerto Rican-y?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, no.
Of course not.
Big. Waspy white girl. I'm blanking on what I was gonna say. No, each record had like a song that I liked, and then I'd be like, the whole rest of it, I think everything else sounds terrible. Everything else sounds like people honking.
What was your Annie song? Was it Tomorrow?
Tomorrow,
of course.
Yeah, because I saw what's her face,
Andrea McArdle,
sing it on every talk show.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
And period. This is a weird thing to remember. After she'd been on like all the talk shows, she went back on another one. Like I don't know why, but the same one. And the host, I can't remember if it was Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin, was like, "Would you sing the song again? Are you tired of singing it yet?" And she's like, "No." she's like 12. She's like 12 years old, and be like, "No, I'm not tired." Like you get this wave of exhaustion. Just pass over her face.
Poor thing. And whatever year I was in chorus, which I can't remember, it was either like late, like grade school or like junior high.
Yeah.
We had to sing, maybe we also sang Tomorrow, but I remember we definitely sang, The Hard Knock Life.
Right.
And so that was, that's a song.
Jay-Z sampled that song in the 90s.
I know. And as much as I hate hip hop, I hate it more when they sample Broadway.
Annie.
Well, specifically, the one I really hate is when that cow, Gwen Stefani, got her mitts on If I Were a Rich Man.
Well, that wasn't a sample. That was just an appropriation.
Well, whatever it was.
She's not a cow.
She, ugh.
She's nice to Gwen Stefani.
I wanted to bring in the Cossacks to make her leave her village. Right, I hated her version so much. We haven't even started
talking about movies
No,
yet.
We haven't, but we'll get there.
We
calm down, people.
There was going to be some segue that I had about this whole thing. Oh, Los Angeles.
Yes.
Why I like living in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
Because we have museums where they show Christian Mark Clay's The Clock.
Yes.
What do you have in other cities that are not Los Angeles? Not that. You might have it in New York. You might have it in London.
San Francisco, maybe.
Maybe San Francisco. But you do not have in your town, yet at least,
right,
the 24-hour screening of Christian Mark Clay's 24-hour film, The Clock. Now, last year, you went to see the first screening
right
of it, and you sat through how many hours?
9 hours.
9 hours of it last year. There was something going on in my life, and I might not have even been in town.
No, you were in town, because part of the reason I left when I did was because I had to get up early the next morning, because you and I had to go see Cowboys and Aliens.
Oh, where? I don't remember now what I was doing then. I don't know what prevented me from seeing it last time, but something prevented me.
Yeah.
And now this time, it just screened again yesterday from noon.
Saturday.
Until noon today.
Yeah.
And you sat through how many hours this time?
This time I did six, but I did the hardest six in terms of my body clock.
Yeah.
I did 1:30 a.m. to 7:30 a.m.
Yeah, that's brutal. I don't know how you did that. I'm
not sure how I did it either.
I
did take donut breaks, because this time they had a 24-hour free donut installation just down the street from LACMA on. Which
every 2 hours, a different donut shop in the city would provide free donuts to people who were attending The Clock.
Well, or to anybody. It wasn't
they advertised it really to people who
And that was great. It's always not, so 3 a.m. I went and got a little sugar buzz, had a chocolate iced yum yum, and then
at 6:15 a.m.
when I ran into you, we went and had a Fonut, which was lovely.
Strawberry buttermilk Fonut.
Yes.
The Fonuts is a place here. It's very fancy. The donuts are like $4 a pop.
Yeah, they're baked.
But and they're baked.
The woman who runs the place was a pastry chef for Jose Andres. Who's the big molecular gastronomy guy. So they're really cool. And they make vegan ones. They have savory ones. I'm a big fan of the chorizo cheddar.
Strawberry buttermilk's my favorite.
Strawberry buttermilk. And I'm not usually, I don't like the fruit stuff, but that was really good.
Those are delicious.
Anyway, so I went at 1:30. I had been, I tried to take a nap yesterday afternoon, and then last night was the Outfest Fusion Gala, where we presented the Outfest Fusion Award to Patrick Ian Polk, and had the world premiere of his new film, The Skinny, which I rather liked, and we'll talk about more in a couple of weeks when it opens. He is distributing it himself and four-walling it around the country. So I think on April 6th, its sort of national tour starts in like D.C. and Atlanta. And
from city to city?
Basically, yeah.
It's not all opening in one.
No. He's doing like two cities at a time or something.
I see. Okay.
So anyway, so when that starts, I'll talk about it more. But anyway, so that was terrific. And then I, at about 11:30 or so, I ate a pint of Java chip Starbucks ice cream.
I think it's fake. I know you think somehow that coffee ice cream keeps you awake, but I don't think it does. I think you should just drink coffee instead of downing an entire pint of chocolate ice cream.
Then I left the house at 1, because I knew from the last time that I saw the clock.
Portion control 2012.
Yeah, I know.
Kicking portion control.
The last time I saw the clock, it was really busy between like 8 and midnight. Like, there were a lot of people sort of popping in to see some of it. So I decided I wasn't going to leave the house until 1 o'clock. So when I left the house at 1 o'clock, I had a can of, my iced mocha.
Right.
So I was pretty wired by 1:20 or so when I went into the theater. And then ran to our friend Graham, who does the Future Shipwreck blog. And then at 3, we went and grabbed the donut and came back for a while. And then while I was in my next phase, you woke up and came over there, right?
I did what I always do. I went to bed at 9 o'clock.
Right.
And normally I wake up on my own without an alarm at around 5 a.m. But last night I set my alarm for 4, an hour before I normally get up. So I was woken by the alarm, which doesn't happen very often.
Right.
But I had had, you know, like 7 hours of sleep, so I was ready to go. Like, I had full night's sleep. So I got up, put on my clothes, drove to Lacma. Took me 10 minutes because no traffic, all green lights.
Right.
And free parking across the street. And I, no line, because it was 4:30
Yeah, there
was the
no line when I got there either.
I waltzed in. I sat there from 4:30 to 6:15 And I took notes. And here is my report.
Let me finish my thing before you get into that. Anyway, okay. so after our donut, you went home. I went back. My original goal was to stay until 8, but I made it to 7:30 and I was starting to kind of like, you know, get a little not attentive. And I thought, okay, but still, that was, I figured, a good 6 hour chunk. So now I've only got 9 to go. Next time they show it, if I can go from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., I will have seen all of the clock.
I'm going to do hour and 45 minute bits.
All right.
Maybe even 90 minutes. Because I love movies, but I also love really long movies. But when it stretches on interminably, like when there's, even though it is finite,
right,
it is only 24 hours long. When I watched the Ken Burns World War II documentary on TiVo, that took me, if you recall,
weeks,
because I would watch it in little 20-minute chunks.
Right.
Because that thing was 22 hours long. Right. And so there was no...
If Prohibition comes on Netflix, we need to watch that one.
I started watching it, and then TiVo started eating it.
So what are your notes?
Here are my notes. So I watched it from 4:30 a.m. to 6:15 a.m. And it didn't bother me to leave when I found you, or when you found me.
Right.
Because Lacma now owns a copy. They own a print or a digital copy or whatever it is.
A digital, I'm sure.
And now that they own it, they're just going to keep screening it.
Of course.
I mean, every so often.
It'll make an event out of it.
Over time, I'll see it all. And eventually, what I will have to do, I'll have to figure out
watching
a way.
Between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. that's going to be your hardest
bit. Yeah, like my hardest bit was going to be like the late evening, super early morning. Like, right. I will have to have a super long nap.
And the really tricky part about that part of it is that not only are you like, you know, trying to stay awake and watch movies at a time when you're normally asleep, a great many of the clips that you are watching are of people sleeping or going to sleep or being awakened in the middle of the night, like by a phone call or whatever. It's like, oh, God, I'm so jealous of you in your pajamas.
Yeah, because it's not only... This movie is, for people who've never heard us discuss this before, this film, every minute of the film coincides with what time it is in real time.
It's all clips from other movies.
All on the clock.
And so you know, like, if somebody gets a phone call in the middle of the night and it says 3:27 a.m. on their clock radio, it's 3:27 a.m.
while you're watching it.
Yeah.
Because they only show it, they only screen it at, you know, the time that it happens to be.
So like, you know, once you hit about 4:35, every hour or half hour, there's a lot of scenes of people turning off their alarm clock.
because that's
the thing in movies.
But here's what I saw. I saw the first thing as I walked in and took my seat, the Amish dude was waking up Harrison Ford.
Oh, time for milking.
Time for milking.
It's 4:45.
4:30.
Oh, is it 4:30?
Yeah, 4:30. Okay, yeah. And that's from Witness.
Yeah.
Then I saw a clip from Videodrome, Gabriel Byrne in Miller's Crossing.
Right.
Then I saw the stripper. Now, she was not part
not
of the
movie. With
she was not part of the movie. But there was a lady there, and it just made me really happy because this is another digression, but it's another reason to love Los Angeles because I don't think other cities have this phenomenon either. I mean, some of them do.
Yeah.
Like probably Las Vegas probably has this. But at 4:40, a woman got up to leave. And she was with some Eurotrash looking dude. But she had long, long hair, the giganticest boobs I have seen in months.
Like, was each one the size of my head?
Yeah.
Wow.
Super boobs. She had gigantic cans.
Like Russ Meyer kind
of. Like Russ Meyer, super vixen, you know, ultra vixen.
Right.
Mega vixen.
Beneath the valley of the ultra milkmaids. Yes.
Yeah. And a super skin tight shirt on. And really skin tight jeans and enormously high Lucite stripper heels. And And I loved that moment because not only was she magnificent to behold, but she was at Los Angeles County Museum of Art at 4:30 in the morning watching a Christian Markley film.
Installation.
Yeah.
Well, her shift probably had just ended.
But where do you expect people to go?
True.
When they're
Denny's,
done,
when not, they're done not
at Spearmint Rhino.
Yes.
She went to the museum.
Yes.
Everywhere you go in Los Angeles, whether it is the low culture moment of your day or the high culture moment of your day, there will be a stripper.
That's true. Invariably.
There will be a stripper there.
There was some lady who was standing like by the parking lot as I was walking into the thing. She goes, "Why are all these people going to the museum in the middle of the night?" And I said, "They're doing a 24-hour movie." She goes, "All right, I'm going to check that out." But I don't know if she ever actually did or not. I didn't see her walk behind me. But it was just like... And why are you standing on this particular corner?
It just made me very happy to think that I live in a city where everybody can do everything. Like, strippers, they go to museums. You think they don't because you're prejudiced against strippers.
Intellectuals, they go to Jumbo's Clown Room
right.
to see the strippers.
Who are then accompanying them to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art.
It's a whole cycle.
Yeah. Then I saw Christopher Reeve in Time After Time.
No, Somewhere in Time.
Somewhere in Time, whatever that movie was called. I knew which one it was.
Yes.
It was the one with him going with Jane
Seymour. With the, that theme music.
Yeah, so, that terrible song. Anyway.
But you know it when you hear it.
Kevin Costner in The Untouchables.
Was it The Untouchables or JFK?
It was The Untouchables.
Okay, because there was also a lot of JFK, like with Sissy Spacek.
Catherine Keener doing something. I don't know what.
Yeah, there were a lot of clips.
Colin Firth from A Single Man.
Yes. Graham asked me, he goes, about how many, what percentage of these clips do you recognize? And I said, well.
Did Graham sit with you?
Yeah, for a while.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, I'd say there are probably about 60% of the clips where I at least recognize who's in the clip.
Yeah.
But as far as like being able to name the movie, it's probably closer to like 40. Because there's a lot of
things. I didn't recognize many of the movies.
Really?
I recognized, you know, the actors for, you know, if they were. I'll say, you know, the contemporary actors, they're easy to identify.
Sure.
When you start getting to those older character actors, you know, people who were, if a woman who was a character actress in 1942, I don't know who she is.
See, that's my bailiwick.
Like, and so, and I mean, if it's Betty Davis, who sure. I jotted her down.
She pops coming. Up. Yeah. There were some Voyager clips.
She was right after Lee Marvin, Angie Dickinson, Sean Connery, Tippi Hedren in Marnie.
Yes. And Lee Marvin, Angie Dickinson was Point Break.
Oh, that was Point Break?
That was Point Break.
Okay. And then there was Betty Davis, Robert Wagner and Steve McQueen.
I need to look that one up. I didn't know what that was.
I couldn't remember what movie that was.
It's not the Sand Pebbles, but it was something where like they were in the army or something.
Emilio Estevez in Stakeout.
Yes, that was recurring all night because, and this is another cool thing about this movie. Whether it's Stakeout or like Rear Window, they take movies where an editor will, you know, like say in the case of Stakeout, you have Emilio Estevez sees something at like 1:38 a.m. and then he doesn't see something until 3:35 a.m. and then he sees something else at 4:46. And in Stakeout, there's edits, so those three things happen in rapid sequence. But if you're watching the clock in real time over the course of the night, hours will go by, and then it's like, oh, and meanwhile, back at Emilio Estevez, he's spotting something, you know. And you know, the same thing with the Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, like where he looks at his watch when Raymond Burr leaves in the middle of the night, and then when he comes back, and so that's part of one of the many cool things about the clock and what it does to time and how it kind of, you know, cuts up movies in this way.
Because right following then was the, speaking of editing, was the snoring sequence.
Yeah.
With Gene Hackman, Vincent Price, and
Cary Grant.
Someone else snoring, and then cutting back and forth to Catherine Deneuve as though she's looking at them all snoring with a look of disgust on her face.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this movie also is that, like, There are chunks in there where you don't know what time it is in the clip you're seeing, but Markley has thrown it in to go thematically with a clip that did have a clock in it, you know? And also, because it's the middle of the night, he'll throw in a random, oh, suddenly it's the nightmare sequence from Spellbound, or it's the nightmare sequence from Vertigo, because you're sleeping.
And they'll be all together. They'll be like boom, boom, boom.
No, they were separated. Well,
but you know what I mean. Like often, many times he'll sequence things.
Yeah, or he'll work in like two different dream sequences and play them off each other or something.
Walter Matthau, can we tell Edgeo 4?
Yeah, and that was Dirty Pretty Things.
Yeah, Dane Cook.
Yes, I was like, what?
And Jessica Alba.
Oh, is that who that was? Yes. So that was what, Good Luck Chuck then?
Sean Connery for the second time.
Yeah, and it was like, I think it was From Russia with Love.
Yeah. And then I looked over directly to my left in my row, and two guys who, about five seats away from me, who were asleep when I walked in, both of them stirred a little bit, kind of woke up a little bit, and then immediately went back to sleep, using each other as pillows. Like, they were sort of snuggling and sleeping at the same time. Not awake at all. 20 minutes. They're just sleeping.
There was that weird, did you see the clip of the guy who's snoring, and it was like a close-up of his nose, and he had one of those curly mustaches?
No.
And it would sort of move up and down? I have no idea what that was from.
That was before I showed up.
Oh, okay.
Clint Eastwood, Samantha Mathis.
Yes.
And here's
yes.
my thing with Samantha Mathis. Whenever I see her in a movie, I go, oh, Samantha Mathis. I love Samantha Mathis. And I don't know why I always have that response about her. But when I see her in a movie, I respond very affectionately toward
her.
Because I think she's great.
She left the movies before we could get sick of her. So we still miss Samantha Mathis.
But she's in movies.
Today?
Yeah.
Like what?
Yeah, she does things. I don't know. We'd have to look her up. But she still does things.
What's the last thing you saw?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Look it up. I have not seen Samantha Mathis in a long time.
When you're talking about something, I'll go look it up.
Fine.
John Cena and Jodie Foster. The only time you're ever going to see them back to back. Humphrey Bogart, Glenn Ford, because I'm old and I know who Glenn Ford, what Glenn Ford looks like. At that point, three super weeded out bros walked past me. Leaving, one of them holding a Tempur-Pedic pillow.
Oh, I saw them. They sat that, near me at one he point. Brought, yes, yes.
But boy, did they reek of the pot smoke. And I just love the guy had the Tempur-Pedic pillow. And I know what a Tempur-Pedic pillow looks like because Gary Cotti has one.
Uh-huh.
And it's this weird, it has like a neck rest thing. And it's a lump.
It's concave.
Yeah, he's just holding it. It's like, we're super baked, man. But I brought my Tempur-Pedic pillow.
I took my pillow with me back before, this is in the early 90s when the New Beverly had not renovated itself yet. And it was still just kind of a mildew pit with hard seats.
Right.
I took a pillow with me because they showed the four-hour NC-17 rated 1900.
Oh, that would have been brutal there.
Well, that's why I brought the pillow.
And then James Cagney, Matt Damon, Danny DeVito, Julie Harris, Bill Hader, Matt Dillon, Max Perlman, Lauren Holly, James Cagney again.
What was the movie with, the movie with Cagney and Dorothy Malone?
Dorothy Malone.
I had no idea they had done a film together. I had to look that up.
Ray Winston. Roddy McDowell, Ron Livingston.
Ray Winston was in that scene with
what's his face?
With Ian McShane and Lee, the general, Brendan Gleeson.
Right.
Yeah.
Sandy Dennis, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton,
Virginia Woolf, George Segal.
George Segal. Swinton.
Leonardo DiCaprio. What was that movie with Swinton stabbing somebody?
I don't know. Leonardo DiCaprio, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Charles Bronson, Michael Sheen, Robin Williams, Gillian Anderson, Chris Noth, Sarah Jessica Parker.
Did you notice there was some TV in there?
There was a couple TV things, a couple TV bits.
A couple Sex in the City, some Alfred Hitchcock Presents, some Mission Impossible. That thing they kept cutting back to with George Sanford Brown and Peter Lupus where they had the weird eye goggles on and they were trying to get the steel bars out. Yeah. I was like, I had no idea there was TV in this thing. But
George Lopez in a little indie movie.
Yeah, what was that?
That I want to say it was called, I saw it and I reviewed it for iFilm back in the day. And I'm looking it up right now on IMDb because
it wasn't like 10 items or less.
No. It was, I found it surprising that they put it in there because, because it was a movie that nobody saw.
Well, look, I'm sure they didn't have a lot of options for like 4:30 a.m. clips. And so they've got a whole scene that's happening with all these like maids or whatever they were checking in. So, you know.
Yeah, oh, they were business office building cleaners.
That's what I thought.
Because that was what the movie is about. Like they were trying to...
It wasn't Bread and Roses.
Organize Bread and Roses. That's the title.
George Lopez is in Bread and Roses?
Yes, he is.
Wow, that's a Ken Loach movie.
I know.
Nutty.
Yeah. And so...
I've never seen it, but...
Sean Connery again for the third time. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Steve Buscemi.
Was that Brick?
I don't know.
Where he puts the glasses on and I've seen
Brick, but I don't. Here's the thing.
You don't.
Movies that I remember, movies I've seen, I'm sure were in these clips, but out of context. And it's just someone like answering a phone or hearing an alarm clock. You're like, I don't know what movie that's from. See, I don't know at all what movie that's from.
Part of the weird way my brain works and that like I don't remember people's names until I've met them like 3 or 4 times.
Right.
But if I've seen a movie and I remember it, I can pretty much tell you.
You're weird.
I can name that tune in 3 notes.
You're weird. Carrie Elwes in Saw.
I recognize that one.
when they show him in the picking up the phone on the floor, I laughed out loud and I thought, well, if Alonzo's in here, he'll hear that, because I went ha ha ha.
I didn't, but I was also laughing out loud, so that's probably
John C. Reilly, Jimmy Stewart, Pauly Shore, Nicole Kidman. Again, a mashup you'll never see.
Yeah, there's a lot of Eyes Wide Shut in the middle of the night.
Jim Carrey, Terrence Stamp, Bradley Cooper, Danny Masterson in what movie? I do not know.
That was The Yes Man.
It was.
I can't think of any other movie that has Jim Carrey and Terrence Stamp in it.
I don't remember Terrence Stamp being in the Yes Man.
Terrence Stamp is like the guru who tells them.
Right. Yeah. I forgot that movie.
I forgot that Bradley Cooper was in that movie.
Paul Newman, Jeff Bridges, The Big Lebowski. I finally, after about an hour, I was like, oh, a movie I know. The Shining, Gene Hackman again in The Conversation, Emma Thompson, Cameron Diaz, James Marsden.
The Cameron Diaz, that was the clip from The Box.
Yes. Yeah. Shaft, Geraldine Page, Harvey Keitel, Richard Pryor, Yaphet Kotto.
Interiors and Blue Collar.
Brad Pitt, Interview with the Vampire, Paul Giamatti in American Splendor, Christian
Slater.
That
was not American Splendor.
Yes, it was.
No.
Yeah.
No. He was waking up in a hotel room. There are no hotel rooms in
American Splendor. I think that was American Splendor.
It was not American Splendor. Wrong. You're wrong.
My very favorite, one of my two favorite things. Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss in What About Bob?
Well, because that was the 6 a.m. clip. And then at like 6:02 is the Bill Murray in Groundhog Day clip. So that was very cool to see those back to back.
Yeah. Jennifer Aniston and Jim Carrey.
Bruce Almighty.
I swear the following clip was from Tsai Ming Liang's What Time Is It There? I don't know that that's true, but I think it was because I remember a scene where the guy grabs the clock and hugs it because he's so far away from this girl he's obsessed with. That's a movie you should see.
I know.
Everybody should see that. Before Sunrise.
Yeah. Somebody was howling with laughter.
Screaming laughing during
at Ethan Hawke reading Auden in the voice of Dylan Thomas.
Screaming giggles.
I couldn't figure out what was so funny about that.
Again and again, like for 30 seconds.
Prolonged, sustained giggling. Yes, yeah. That was weird.
At that moment, I looked over. The giggling did not wake up the sleeping guys, who remained asleep the entire time that I was there.
Now, did you see the guys taking flash photographs while you were there?
There were a lot of jerks with cameras.
Oh, I hate that.
And the security people
were not doing
anything.
Listen up,
LACMA. Your people that you hire to do their job at these events aren't doing their job.
All they did was get people not to stand in the aisle.
Yeah.
But they were totally not paying attention to the rolling bottles or the flash photos.
Yeah. Nicolas Cage in that EMT movie. I can't remember now what it was.
Bringing Out the Dead.
Burt Lancaster, Kirsten Dunst in Virgin Suicide, Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo.
There was also Good Morning Vietnam.
Good Morning Vietnam. Judi Dench and Maggie Smith in
Ladies
in Lavender. A film I saw at the Arclight with my friend Chris Gardner. We were the only men in the audience. Well,
of course you were.
Ellen
and
Barkin.
You held your pinkies out the whole time.
We did. We held our pinkies out while we ate
Scones.
Ellen Barkin.
And I think Coffee and Cigarettes.
And Tom Waits. That Australian dude, Adam, what's his face from Coyote Ugly?
Oh, Garcia?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't recognize him.
Rosanna Arquette. Then the guys, the sleeping dudes woke up and left. It was about 6.
Oh, there was a lot of after hours all night as well, which was fun.
Tom Hanks. And Hooch,
yes. Tom Hanks in that period where he and Robert Abele looked the most alike.
Meryl Streep, Reese Witherspoon, Harrison Ford again, Anthony Perkins, Earl Holliman, and then you said, let's go get a donut.
Yes, Earl Holliman was the last thing we saw before going to get donuts. Wow, you know what? Anybody who tuned into this podcast to hear us talk about the Hunger Games is getting really annoyed by
that. We saw the Hunger Games this week, and I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it a little less than you, but I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. I enjoyed it actually for a reason that I've heard other film critics have not enjoyed it. And I don't think we need to go on very long about Hunger Games, honestly. I mean, because what are you doing? Are you going to pour cocoa all over your computer keyboard?
Yes. That's what I'm going to do.
You're holding the mug over the...
It's virtually empty.
You're holding the mug over the keyboard as though you're going to pour cocoa on the keyboard.
Because that's something I'd do.
I don't know. Maybe
unless you were to stop me.
Maybe your brain is having a problem. Keep
your own house in order, Dave.
Maybe this is the first day of you having a brain problem that's going to require me becoming your full-time caretaker. What would that be like?
You would love that level of control over my life. Don't front like you wouldn't.
So we see the Hunger Games, and I think, and this is going to sound like a criticism, but I find it to be a sort of featureless movie. Meaning,
in terms of,
meaning that it is
authorial voice
directed by a man who has no imprint
right
on the films he makes. Like, he is a
workmanlike,
he is a serviceable director who can do things efficiently. And now you are licking the inside of your cocoa cup.
This is really good cocoa.
Yeah, it sure is. You know why? Because I made it.
I know.
I've heard people who did not like this movie say that they did not like it. One of the several reasons I've heard people not like it, because it lacks an authorial stamp, like is what you said earlier.
Right.
There's no directorial voice or perspective. And they're right about that. There isn't. But this is a product.
Well, if anything, I think it's meant to reflect the authorial stamp of Suzanne Collins.
Yeah, and I think this guy, Gary Ross, he got out of the way of the product.
Right.
And that's fine by me if the movie is efficient and fun and it moves and it tells a story that I want to keep watching. And
I mean, would you say that
it did all those things?
Would you say that any of the Harry Potter movies had an authorial stamp, a directorial stamp on them?
I think the later ones, as they got darker, and the Alfonso Cuarón one did, and then the later ones, as they got darker and more difficult, that mm-hmm. was David Yates,
yeah, and Mike Newell.
I think that those guys, they, I think the team of people, the Harry Potter Inc., decided right. on a tone.
Well, they were a different tone from the Chris Columbus movies, but I'm saying but that's not the same as like, you know.
No, if Pedro Almodovar had come in,
exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but again, I like those Harry Potter movies. You know, similarly.
I mean, like I think that the Twilight Breaking Dawn is better than most of the Twilight movies because Bill Condon directed it.
Yes,
but there's not a lot that I can point to in that and say, ah, yes, this is a Condon moment. You know,
but things that he's done in other movies. Things that you know where where he's come from, things that he's done in other films
sure.
found their way into Breaking Dawn.
Absolutely.
Which is why that as a viewing experience, it's my favorite of the four. Is it four?
Yeah, so far, yes.
Because two and three are crap and boring.
Yes.
Number one is interesting only in that it was the beginning of a hysterical phenomenon.
Right.
and that I was hoping that that Catherine Hardwicke, yeah, that was she, mm-hmm. yeah, that she would take it farther than she did, although she really didn't. She was a good choice for the first one because the idea of a girl in trouble
fits
what she does. And
but,
so,
but I think
next to the Condon one is all over the place and really weird and has more Cronenbergian stuff in
right,
it,
yes.
which is all I need. But what I'm
getting at is I think that with these mega books, you don't hire a director who's gonna mess with it because your main goal is to satisfy the readers.
Yes.
And to let them feel like they're recreating the experience of the book
yes.
in movie form. Yes. I mean, like, hiring Fincher to direct Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, on the one hand, is kind of a bold move.
Yes.
But ultimately, it's still working within his wheelhouse of the kind of movie he would have done anyway.
Yes.
So, yes. you know, so, yeah, I think that there's, if you're adapting a short story or, like, a novel that nobody read, then you can go buck wild with it and do what you want. But when you are doing these big, big bestsellers and everybody is looking forward to, you know,
this movie, you know, you...
I want to see the thing I've already imagined in my head.
Exactly.
I want to see it happen so that when it happens, I can cheer.
Right. You have a tether that you can't really get very far
she
from.
She just held up her three fingers.
Now, the screening that you and I attended, which was part press and part fan, was pretty sedate. It was not like the hootenanny that we saw at Twilight. But we had breakfast this morning with two friends who went to the Thursday midnight
show. Apparently, it's a jamboree in these theaters.
Oh,
this
yeah. They were like, they said every time a new character was introduced or somebody did a recognizable thing from the books, that like people went nuts.
Yeah. I'm glad we didn't sit with any of those people.
Yeah, that would have gotten tiresome.
I mean, it would have been interesting. It would be interesting on a second viewing, maybe.
Sure.
But
not when you're trying to take it in.
Yeah. Has never read the books and who has no intention of reading the books.
Ditto.
I wanted to see it without assistance.
Right.
And so that's what we got. I was very happy. I'm pleased all around. I think
it's fine. I think it delivers what you want it to do. Yeah. It's nothing spectacular, but it's
I enjoyed it much more than you did.
It's fine. It works. I'm not dreading the prospect of sequels.
No. I'm actually looking forward to the next one.
And the inevitable two movies they'll make out of the third book.
Yeah. And I want them to get gorier. That would be my wish.
That's not going to happen.
I know. But that would be my wish.
This movie made oodles of money this weekend, so PG-13 is going to be the way to go from here on.
But I wish the killings had been more killish.
Right. They do kind of hold back on that.
Now, speaking of killings that were extremely killish, I saw the greatest film of all time this week. Actually, 2 weeks ago. And I've been holding my enthusiasm in public.
Because now it's finally opening in some cities.
Gareth Hugh Evans is a director who's Welsh and also Indonesian, I think. I'm not sure.
Why not?
Exactly. There's an Indonesian film called The Raid, Redemption. Apparently, it's the beginning of a
series of the Raid movies.
Yeah. And
based on the popular insecticide.
Kind of. a squadron of 20 elite SWAT police go into a building that's more like a bunker, an apartment building, where the evil, sleazy crime lord lives with all these other, like, rapists and murderers and criminals and drug dealers and the most evil scum in all of, like, Jakarta. and somehow he knows that the cops are coming. And when they come, all the cameras are on, and it's like an apartment building, but it's also like a cell block. And the baddest ass of
It's like a slum they've turned into a fortress, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
The baddest ass of the SWAT cops is this guy who's, at the very beginning of the movie, you see him doing his morning prayers and then doing like super exercises and then kissing his pregnant wife's belly. Then he's got to go off to work as a SWAT cop.
Does he have an elephant?
You would begin to think that he does have an elephant by the middle of this film. Because as I watched it, I thought, oh man, Tony Jaa, you better watch out. Because this guy, what's his name?
Mm.
Iko something. I'm going to get his name for you later.
Okay.
Maybe I'll get his name for you right now.
All right. I did not see this movie, so I don't have the goods.
I'll go with you.
Okay.
Iko Uwais. This guy... And to give everyone else their props, not just this guy, but everybody else in this movie, is a master of fighting. It is the most nonstop fighting movie I've seen in I don't know how long. It is the best action movie I've seen in I don't know how long. It is the most violent, crazy, crazy violent movie that I have seen in I don't know how long. It is like the most ecstatically brutal thing that I have witnessed in, again, I don't know how. I don't even have the words to describe how happy I was made by this film, because it is almost a pure thing. Like, you know, we talk about sometimes
the movie, it is sheer sensation.
The movie Crash, the good one, the Cronenberg one,
right,
is just like car accident, brooding obsessive people, sex.
Yeah.
And that's just like a loop,
right,
of that. And then if you ever saw the Robert Duvall movie, The Apostle, same thing. Preaching, 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 preaching. Brooding, 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 brooding. And it's a loop. And so, in a way, these movies have this very sort of pure existence. Like, they don't go off in any tangents.
They're zen.
They are exactly the thing that they are, to a hypnotic degree.
They are always about what they are about.
Yeah. That's what this is. Fighting. So much fighting. The greatest amount of fighting. And creative, inventive, just exhilarating, exhausting fighting. And there are twists plot-wise. Like, it's, I said in my review, it's almost showboating how in the middle of all the fighting comes, oh yeah, there's plot stuff happening.
Sorry.
With, like, betrayals and the brotherhood and, you know, the honor of this and this guy, you know, a secret and it's done in sort of with this emotional resonance that you don't even need. You know, all you need is more like people getting their head smashed 20 times in a row and then stabbed in the face and then, you know, put through a veggie juicer. Like, that's all you want, but you get a real story as well. And boy, is it just the greatest thing I've ever seen in my entire life up till right now.
Wow, okay. Well, I want to see it. You've definitely sold me.
So. Roger Ebert hated this movie so much. This movie had like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes until one old guy who I don't know his name, who got flamed so hard like on the
Cole
site.
Smithy or one of those
No, it wasn't
guys,
Cole or? Smithy. It was someone else. And now Roger Ebert. I dig Roger Ebert. He wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
He's one of the coolest movie critic guys ever.
Absolutely.
He personally called me out by name and dissed me for making fun of the terrible Crash.
Yes, he did.
The one about racism.
He was very good to me in my first year as artistic director of the USA
Film
Festival.
I felt honored that he called me out by name.
No, that was a big thing.
And called me glib and terrible in print. He did that.
He did.
It's one of my proudest moments, because I was like, wow. A, Roger Ebert read something I wrote. That was gratifying. Secondly, he hates me now. And he hates me over something stupid. One of the stupidest movies to come out in the past decade that he loved.
Yes.
And that won the Best Picture Oscar. And I had, and I wasn't even alone in hating that movie.
No.
Like, I was one of many people who hated that movie. But I don't know, something about the way I wrote my negativity got under his skin.
Well, because you dared to, like, not take it seriously.
I didn't just say it was a bad movie. I openly mocked it in my review.
Yeah. Which means that you're a total racist.
Which means I'm a total racist. So.
Why do you hate black people, Dave White?
For the same reason that you deny the Holocaust.
There you go.
Yeah. And, but so, yeah, it was fantastic. Like, that was a moment where I was like, oh, man, look, Roger Ebert hates my guts.
And now he hates The Raid.
And now he hates The Raid, which doesn't make me hate him at all. I still think he's great. Yeah. But boy, does he hate that movie.
But hey, you know what? And he loved Speed 2.
He even insulted the people who like it. Like, it was one of those reviews. It was one of those reviews where you insult the people who might actually like the film.
Right.
Because he called people who like it
fanboys. That's right, you told me.
Fanboys. Yeah. I've never been a fanboy.
No.
No.
You're a fan man.
I'm just a fat man. I'm not a fan man. I'm just a fat man.
Potato, potato.
And there's another movie that came out this week?
Yeah, Deep Blue Sea.
Oh, The Deep Blue Sea.
Not to be confused with the Rennie Harlan shark epic.
No.
This is Rachel Weisz stars. It's based on the play.
Tell them what it's about.
Was it a play? By Terrence Rattigan?
Yes.
A play by Terrence Rattigan, directed by British director Terrence Davies. It is England after World War II, so you can imagine how drab everything is.
1950.
And Rachel Weisz is stuck in a stifling marriage to an older judge who is, you know, who likes her a lot, but is a total dullard.
I didn't buy their marriage.
Really?
No. You know why?
Why? She's too hot?
Look at her. Look at her. What, is she actually 40, do we think now? Probably? Maybe?
I suppose.
Look at her.
But, yeah, but look, you know, hot women marry futzy old dudes with titles and money all the time.
I suppose. I guess you're right.
Yeah, I bought. I didn't have any problem buying that.
I bought her not being into him. I know
that. Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, and that's the point of the film. So she winds up having an affair.
She's distracting to me.
Because she's so gorgeous?
She's an actress. She's a good actress.
Yeah.
And I like her as an actress.
Yeah.
But I can't stop thinking about how beautiful she is when I look at her.
She is stunning.
Like, I look at her and I just go, oh my God, look how pretty. You're such a pretty lady. Like, I feel almost like...
And now she got her some James Bond on the side.
Yeah, so. I almost feel like, I know this is what makes me laugh when you guys do What the Flick.
Mm-hmm.
Ben is always the first guy to be like, I sure do like fill in the blank.
Right.
You know, whatever. He has no qualms. Problem, no qualms about saying, about talking about which actresses he likes in the real way where it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always considered myself to be like, you know, I don't think of myself as a real film critic, but I always think that I shouldn't go down that road with anybody.
Sure.
Male or female. Right. Like if I've got a crush on some dude, actor, you're not going to hear about it in my review at all. Period.
No.
Zero. But when I see Rachel Weisz, I feel like a blithering, I feel like it's like a dumb straight dude. Cause I, in that moment, I understand what straight guys see when they see a woman like that. It's like, it makes you feel dumb. It makes you feel stupid in your head because all you can do is look at them and go, pretty.
I know what you mean. But is she the kind of woman that renders straight guys speechless, or is she the kind of woman who is attractive in a way that makes gay guys speechless? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know.
Daniel
Craig likes something about her.
Well, obviously. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? There are women who are like striking beauties.
No, she's gorgeous.
But there are women who like, you know, who like straight guys are all like, about. And they're not necessarily always the same thing.
Well, okay, she's older. She's not Jessica Alba.
Right. You know. But even when she was younger, though, I mean, like, she's complicated.
She's super beautiful.
She's gorgeous. Yeah,
she's super beautiful. And there's, no, I don't think it's I mean, obviously, because I'm not a straight guy, obviously the feeling is something different.
Right.
You know, it's not like I'm, you know.
Well, it's like.
It's not like I'm entertaining fantasies.
No,
about
no,
her
I know.
Or
well, it's like I was just, but I was,
I, mean,
I was
you
just.
You know what I'm saying? It's like this whole thing where I'm struck dumb by her.
Sure.
Like I look at her and I go, pretty lady. Well, like I can't process anything else.
I was just rereading parts of Screening Party and in the Flashdance chapter, like Dennis talks about how, like, you remember seeing a picture of Jennifer Beals when the movie came out and thinking, oh, I love her. And Lauren says, well, that's how you know you were gay, because straight guys never think, you know, oh, I love her. They think I want to bang her, you know.
Well, yeah, but it's.
And so is Rachel Weisz the kind of beauty that gay men go, I love her, or is she the one that makes straight guys go, I want to hit that?
I don't know, because I don't want to hit that.
If we have any straight listeners, please drop us a note.
I also don't have that thing of, oh, I love her. You know, like it's not, I know what you're talking about.
Right.
But I never have that feeling either for women.
Okay.
Like I don't have that, like, pal affection, oh, I love her kind of thing.
I see.
I see her and I see someone who's really beautiful and I can't think about anything else other than how beautiful they are.
I know. Charlize Theron is kind of the same way.
Charlize Theron is exactly the same.
Yeah.
When I watch that commercial that she's in right now where she walks in slow motion, I think, she's coming to get me.
Must sacrifice a goat.
Yeah, like the yeah, like and she's that beautiful in person because I don't know if I mentioned this on the show before, but I bumped into her that night at the opera.
Right,
like brushed up against her accidentally, like, and she's real. Like that's how she looks in real life.
I collided with Michelle Endegeocello last night.
Not the same thing.
No. Anyway, so in Deep Blue Sea, Rachel Weisz is married to this older guy, but she winds up having a torrid affair and leaving her husband for a rakish but shallow flyboy vet played by Tom Hiddleston, who played Loki in the Thor movies and was F. Scott Fitzgerald in Midnight in Paris. He was in War Horse. He's like, he's everywhere lately.
He was one of the War Horse's custodians.
Yes. He's the other Benedict Cumberbatch. You're seeing him all over the place.
He's better looking
than Benedict. But he's the cuter one, yes.
He's better looking than Benedict Cumberbatch.
And yeah, so basically it's about...
No one has a tumbler of animals that look like Tom Hiddleston.
Tom, no. So, you know, the movie is basically about, like, Rachel Weisz dealing with, you know, her decisions and how these men make her happy and unhappy in different ways, and that sort of awful period of post-war British grayness, you know, where the food was rationed and everything was just sort of grim. And it's very Terrence Rattigan. He's the guy that did, like, the Browning version and the Winslow Boy. Like, he does a lot of that sort of British repression and suffering kind of story. And it fits
sad.
Exactly. And it fits perfectly for Terrence Davis, who is all about, like, you know...
Sad.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's a melancholy film, but it's beautifully done.
The movie opens with her failed suicide attempt. Yes. That's how the movie opens.
And and she does it in one of those flats where you have to put coins in the box to get gas to come out. That's how grim her suicide attempt is. That it requires change.
And yeah.
She needs a shilling to off herself.
A few pence.
A few, yes. A few bob.
A few pence to commit suicide properly. She fails, of course, or there would be no movie.
Right. Anyway, she's terrific. The movie is quite moving and
it's really good.
Beautiful to look at and
extremely
languorous
and quiet.
Yes.
It's very, very quiet.
There are a few confrontation scenes, but there's a lot of staring.
Lots of quiet things, quiet times, quiet observations.
Tiny betrayals. Little disappointments.
I'll tell you, it's a bummer. Kind of all around, it's a bummer.
But in a good way.
But in a good way. And the kind of really emotional, sort of vulnerable kind of acting that feels old-timey all by itself.
Sure.
You know, the kind of, like, I'll die without you, that kind of thing. Yeah. Like, you don't see that very often anymore. Like, you see that in old-timey movies. And when you see it in old-timey movies, you just think, oh, well, that's how people were. They were idiots back then, you know.
And pre-feminism.
They even give you an out if you're that kind of person. Because there's a landlady in the movie, and I reference her in my review.
Right, who kind of, like...
My review has not posted yet on movies.com, and I'm not sure why. I know there's you know... ilovemovies.com. There's always some kind of technical glitch going on.
Well, where, it probably because they tried posting it and it went up under the shark movie or something.
Yeah,
you know?
My review will probably post on Monday. But anyway, I referenced the landlady who says, you know, there's a lot of people talk a lot of rubbish about love. She goes, you know what it is? It's wiping someone's ass and then changing the sheets when they wet themselves.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's which not is worth what killing
she's
yourself.
Doing.
For her own husband.
For her own husband, her old elderly husband. She's getting old too. And so, and as I watch the movies, this comes at about 75% of the way through the movie when this conversation happens. And I sat there and I thought, yes, you are right, landlady. Tell her a thing about love so that she stops acting like such a twit.
Stop mooning over that Tom Hiddleston. He's bad news.
He's a jerk.
Yeah.
His character is such a jerk. That and so full of himself that he feels like it is an appropriate response on a daily basis to ignore someone as beautiful as Rachel Weisz.
Yeah.
And so it's in the end, you know, you're sort of like, okay, I get it. England is having to decide what direction it's going to take after the war. It's sort of muddled and lost as a country. And even though the war's over and they won the war, it's still a sort of a broken shambles of a place.
Right. And is it going to be about the posh aristos, or is it going to be about the brash young breed of, you know, whatever?
And so she, her actions are mirroring
the nation.
This, like, she is stuck
right
between two crappy
choices,
and she has to figure out a way through.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, and she carries along with the really beautiful art direction and mm-hmm. and great sort of, like, you know, quiet, sort of very sure-handed
direction.
Filmmaking. She carries the movie. If it came out in November, mm-hmm. she'd get an Oscar nomination.
Well, it's funny. I spoke with the publicist about that very thing because there was an article that popped up about how this was sort of an awards contender.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah. And I said, I don't know. And he goes, well, why not? And I said, well, because it's a movie that's coming out in March. And he said, well, we actually...
Nobody even knows this movie's opening.
I know.
No word, no buzz, no advance. Okay. It's an art house movie. It's not getting a wide release.
But he said that, he goes, we had talked about launching it in November with that in mind.
Right.
But we just thought it was going to get lost in the shuffle. And he's totally right. It would have been.
Right.
So at least with this one, especially if they can time the DVD release to not happen until, like, October.
Right.
Maybe there's an opportunity.
Not going to happen.
Well, depending on what the field is like. I mean, like last year, you'll recall, there was a ton.
A lot of women.
Of Best Actress contenders. If this year winds up being not so much a year for that sort of thing, you never know. I mean, it's an outside chance. It's a dark horse, but I wouldn't completely rule it out.
Just watch it if you get a chance.
Yeah,
it's really
good. That to the side. Forget awards crap. It's a terrific movie. You should totally see it, especially now that spring is coming. If you have a day like the one we're having, where it's overcast and rainy and damp,
perfect weather to go see. Cold, rainy day. Yeah.
Yes.
There are no machetes, hammers, or axes being used on anyone in this film.
Unlike The Raid. Is that what you're saying?
Maybe there should be. If it were going to be a real, like a five-star kind of movie.
That's what's holding it back?
Not enough giant monster fighting?
Not
enough hammers, machetes, or axes in the new Terrence Davies movie.
As opposed to all those other Terrence Davies movies.
With the hammers, machetes, and axes.
With all the berserker rage in them. Boy. All right, what's your DVD?
You want her to karate chop him in the neck.
Well, ideally,
You want her to do the Indonesian martial arts, like Pencak Silat, or whatever the name of that Indonesian martial art
or
is.
Or maybe a little Krav Maga.
Whatever it takes. You want Rachel Weisz to kick these dudes in the face by the end of the film.
I didn't hate the husband. The husband's actually all right.
The husband was all right.
He's super understanding and, you know, obviously cares for her.
Like, he wanted her back.
Yeah.
At the end.
Even despite the fact that she'd been living with this guy
and
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, it's the husband's mother is another case.
Rachel Weisz lets her have it, which is one of my favorite parts.
Anyway, what's your DVD pick this week, Dave White?
What time is it there?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
What time is it there?
All right.
Tsai Ming-Liang. He's a
Taiwanese?
Taiwanese director. Beautiful movie about a guy who is obsessed with a woman that he meets at his watch-selling kiosk, and then she goes off to France. And it's also very tied in with his mother, who believes that the spirit of their dead father has become reincarnated as the family fish in the aquarium, and that he personally, as a young man, is also sort of obsessed with the movie The 400 Blows.
And Jean-Pierre Léaud is in this movie,
yeah.
Right?
All
right.
And so it's great. It's another example of my favorite current trend in Asian cinema. Point the camera at something and let 15 minutes pass.
All righty then.
I can't recommend it highly enough. I know that when it came to Los Angeles, it played at the New Art, and apparently 6 people went to see it.
Mm.
But he's one of my favorite directors of right now. TSAI is how you say the name? Tsai Ming-Liang.
I'll post a link on the Facebook page.
But yeah, get that. Go watch that. That's a weird, weird, cool, strange, quiet movie that is actually very moving.
Okay.
It's a moving movie.
All righty then. My DVD recommendation this week is the Mystery Science Theater Volume 23 box set, which is coming out this week. One of which is one of the four films that are featured in the set is Last of the Wild Horses.
Does Mary Jo make any money from these box sets?
She does not.
Not a dime?
I don't think so. I know. It's a crock.
What's her PayPal address?
I'm not going to give that out. I will say that if you want to support Mary Jo Peel, you can buy her book as a book or a Kindle.
That's a good idea. Buy her book. Buy her book.
Employee of the Month and Other Stories.
She is our friend. She used to be on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
She's now a member of Cinematic Titanic.
Cinematic Titanic. She's got a book called Employee of the Month.
Which is very
funny. She's making a dime from these MST box sets.
I know.
That sucks.
Anyway, but the new MST box set, the reason I was recommending it is because one of the four films featured is Last of the Wild Horses, which fans of the show will recall has the whole Mirror Mirror inspired host segments where the evil version of Mike and the Bots wind up in Deep 13 and the nice versions of Frank and Dr. Forrester sit in the theater.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, it... That's the one that gave us the immortal line, the double cranch.
Oh, I guess I did see that one.
Yeah, I believe you did.
No. That's all I remember from it.
Yeah. Well, it's not a very good movie.
I guess it's because I didn't watch them obsessively over and over and over and over like this other guy I know who's really into Mystery Science.
I regret theater, nothing.
Who had video VHS tapes of them that he would watch again and again and again and again and again. Like... hundreds of times.
No, that's you're exaggerating.
Whose initials are Alonzo Durelli.
Shut your hole. That you are totally exaggerating.
I don't know that I am.
I paid attention to the show. I didn't
fanboy.
I did not watch them hundreds of times.
Fan club member.
Yeah. Information club.
Fanboy.
I'm information boy. Thank you very much.
Stalked Mary Jo.
I did not. That is a lie.
No, it's all right. It's a lie.
We are very good friends.
I'm lying. No, I am actually lying.
And we are both.
I'm frequently lying. You are. Actually.
We are both quoted on her new book.
Oh yeah, because we are both fans. Yeah, we're both quoted. I forgot about that. Yeah. We're both quoted in. Like on the back or in the inside blurb?
On the frontispiece.
Oh, yeah, that's right. My quote's really good, too.
It is.
By the way.
In fact, actually, I think that in the very first page of the book, there's a quote from Dave, there's a quote from me, and in between us, there's a blurb from Joel Hodgson. So we're in good company.
We're fancy.
There you go. We thank you once again for listening to this very long and incredibly meandering episode, even by...
How long would we go?
We have passed 77 minutes. But it was worth it just to find out about your secret past.
You say it was worth it. As a show tune collector. People listening are going to think it was worth it.
No one has ever complained that our episodes are too long, only that they're too short. This may change this week. Who knows? Anyway, you can drop us a line and tell us what you think about the length of the episode or anything else. If you're a straight guy, your feelings about Rachel Weisz, whatever.
Yeah, I would like to know,
do straight guys think I want to hit that?
Yeah, do you want to hit Rich? Do you want to, not hit? Do not you want? Hit. Do you want to make sweet love to Rachel Weisz?
Let us know. Our email
or
is,
George Lopez or
Dane Cook
or Dane Cook.
Our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and we would love to hear from you. You can follow us on, you can like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can follow us at Twitter at Linoleum Cast. You can check into the show on Get Glue. We are listed under TV shows and not podcasts, but it still counts. Our friend Anthony, by the way, has become the guru of the show, which is the thing you can do on Get Glue where you become.
I don't know what that means.
It's sort of like kind of a mini fan club president where like.
You just appoint yourself the guru?
I think you have to get other people to vote for you to be the guru. I'm not really entirely sure. But anyway, he's our guru now. So thanks, Anthony. Want to recommend our friends, of course, the Popcorn Mafia, the Comedy Couch, Blowhard, Fat Guys at the Movies, the Criterion Cast, the Showbiz Sandbox, Secretly Timid, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, and the Schmoes Know. Want to, of course, ask folks to please, if you have not already, go to iTunes and write us a nice review if you like the show. Let people know that you like the show, and it'll help them find us. tell your friends about the show. We are trying to build an audience, which we have been doing, shockingly enough, ever so gradually.
Our millimeter by millimeter.
Our numbers climb the tiniest bit each time. So we appreciate you getting out and spreading the word and, you know, posting the links on your Facebook pages and all that good stuff.
Yeah, you should all be doing that. You should all be posting the links on your Facebook pages. If you like us, you should post the link on your Facebook page. Yeah.
It would be lovely. We would appreciate it.
No, it wouldn't just be lovely. I think you are obligated. Do it.
I'm not forcing anybody.
Obey me.
Anyway, we thank you for joining us again, and we will... Actually, you are not going to be here next week.
No, I'm going to Texas.
We have a special guest.
Who's the special guest?
Matt Atchity, the editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes.
Your brother.
Gay
brother.
My gay brother. And my co-host on What the Flick, who people on YouTube either think that he's the gay one or that we're related or that we are Fat Beardo 1 and 2.
That's the one I like the best. I like Fat Beardo 1 and Fat Beardo 2.
We generally argue over who gets to be 1.
The cat in the hat.
Exactly. Kind of thing 1 and thing 2. So that'll be...
No, I'm going to Texas just for 3 days. They've got my mom in hospice care now. And so I got to go.
Yes.
I got to get there. And I'll be doing way more important things than you'll be doing.
Fine. I will keep this enterprise afloat while you deal with your family issues, because I care about our business, our company.
Also, you care about my mommy.
I do.
As well.
And so you're doing one thing and I'm doing the other. We're keeping it all afloat.
But the thing I'm doing is more important.
We are spinning all the plates.
Way more important.
We can have career and family. We can bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan.
Okay, goodbye.